Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and today is Friday, September 30th. It's 2:35 Pacific Summer Time, and I'm doing a hybrid audio in here today. So I'm going to record what we've got on the screen here, but I'm also recording the audio concurrently, and then it'll be a subscriber's choice whether they want to listen to the audio or whether they want to have the audio accompanied with some slides, or at least some charts from the chart library. And of course, Deutsche Bank has really been setting the world alight in terms of the headlines in this week. And you can see from this chart that it has been trending lower since 2014. The pace of the trend has picked up this year, and it has basically fallen from just around $25 late last year to a low of 10 this week. But announcements today by the Department of Justice in the US that they were agreeing or potentially agreeing to negotiate with, or negotiating and have possibly reached an agreement that the fine that they were going to impose on Deutsche Bank is going to be quite a bit less than was originally anticipated, has resulted in Deutsche Bank posting an upside key day reversal. And you can quite clearly see that the low is a new low, and it's closing way above the high of the previous day. And in fact, it's above the high from almost last week. So that is a pretty emphatic short-term move. And when you look at the trend over the last year, it's had a number of these. And there's a short-term oversold condition. And now what it really has to do is to break the progression of lower rally highs. There's been a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs, and that will be the true test of whether this low is anything other than a short-term bounce. I think it is worth considering that while every headline has mentioned Deutsche Bank, then Banco Monte dei Paschi di Siena in Italy, the world's oldest bank, is flirting with bankruptcy. It's trading at 18 and a bit cents, and there has been no move there at all. Now, there is increasing speculation that they have reached some form of agreement that they'll be able to sell off some of their bad loans, or at least move the bad loans off of the balance sheet. Now, that's potentially good news because it removes at least a source of it remain it re removes a source of worry for investors. Now, because that has been the factor that most people have been worried about, that and I saw headlines to the extent even last night that Deutsche Bank could be Europe's Lehman Brothers. I think that's very unlikely because that Deutsche Bank can access abundant liquidity from the ECB. They're not going to allow Deutsche Bank to fail. What they may, on the other hand, do is that if things really did get bad, they would nationalize it. That's what they've been doing left and right, that they've been nationalizing banks when the problems get too large. And that really is the risk, because it is not it's not legal for, or at least under the rules that such as they are written. And then, of course, depending on how those rules are interpreted and then who those rules are applied to, but let's just say that the rules, such as they are, would say that you can't bail out banks. But that doesn't mean you can't nationalize them, and maybe nationalize a number of banks, put them all together, create a bad bank for the other assets, and then refloat those a new bank onto the stock market. That would, I think, probably sidestep a lot of the Eurozone's rules against bailouts. And of course, recapitalization of the Italian banking sector is, will be required, even because they have such an enormous debt problem. And we still have the uncertainty, and that is probably going to be resolved at least partially in December when the Italians vote on a referendum to reform the Senate, because Renzi, the Prime Minister, has made quite clear that he will resign if that referendum doesn't pass. Well, what does that mean? It means that today was good news, that for the banking sector in Europe overall. There are still significant medium-term challenges, but this has been another instance where the problem has got kicked a little bit further down the road. So what it has in fact done has been to add a tailwind to risk assets. And if we look at, for example, the DAX index, then there is just one very important consideration, and it is that it is still trading above that psychological 10,000 level. And when you look at it on the weekly chart, what are you presented with? But it was a progression of lower rally highs all the way from early 2015, and that progression of lower rally highs has been broken. Now, if you were to contrast that with Apple, then you're actually presented with a very similar set of circumstances. Apple has been trending lower for much of the last year and is now trading back above the 200-day moving average and looking like it is on a recovery trajectory. So if one would be willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the chart action based on Apple's performance, then one should probably give the same degree of confidence to the chart action if one is looking at the DAX. And when we look at the a number of those other indices that we have in Europe, so for example, if you look at France, and it really does help to remember that you don't buy countries when you're investing in the stock market, you're really buying companies, and France has got quite a considerable number of them. And when you look at this chart action, it hasn't yet been able to break the progression of lower rally highs. It hasn't yet been able to sustain a move above the 200-day moving average, but neither is it falling. So we are at a point where there is the potential for the Eurozone to potentially rally if conditions in the banking sector at least ease, and that would at least set us up for a couple of months rally before people really start to come back in and ask big questions as we head into 2017, because 2017 is going to be a big year where you are going to have whatever the ramifications are of the Italian referendum. You're going to have to st It is looking increasingly likely that the UK will start its negotiations about exiting the EU next year. There's going to be a French and a German election. So it is going to be a year for significant political upheaval in Europe. And, I think that there is something that is worth considering, and it's quite simple. In the decade from, shall we say, 2003 until about 2012, what we had overall was a generally benign environment where we didn't really have to worry about currency market volatility. We didn't have to worry about politics intervening overly in the stock market. We really did have to look at monetary policy, but the dollar started rallying, and that has upset a lot of it has changed the status quo, I think would probably be a better way of thinking about it, because there was a significant period of time that the dollar was either falling or was trading in a range relative to the euro and the yen. But relative to, for example, Asian currencies or the Latin American currencies, then you were presented with an environment where the dollar had been trading down for really a significant amount of time. And when you look at it, say the Asian dollar index, that had an important bottom in 2001, and then it peaked in late 2011. So what are we presented with now when we look at the global markets? What we are presented with is significantly more currency market volatility. That was pretty predictable. We did talk about that in the audio, and we've written about it in the copy from about 3 or 4 years ago. But what it is, it's having a continued effect on the market. that we're no longer going to have these decade-long trends in currencies, that we're going to have significant moves nonetheless, but they'll probably be 1 to 2 years in duration. And that means that there's going to be a sort of an ebbing and a flowing of capital in and out of markets based on the variability of their currencies. But one of the additional reasons that we are having this, we're feeling the necessity to talk about politics, is not least because of the effect that the dollar rally had on the commodity complex, the knock-on effect that the fall in commodity prices had on the economies of commodity producers, and most particularly in the Middle East. And then the there is, of course, the additional fact that we have been in a bond bull market for 36 years. It is the greatest bull market in history, and I'm going to be 40 in November, so I think we could say I've never seen a bond bear market. Anyone who's anywhere close to my age has never seen a bond bear market. And in fact, considering that we don't start work at the age of zero, you would probably have to be well in excess of 60 to have worked or lived through or experienced a time in the markets when there was a significant bond bear market. And that is something that is really something that we do have to take into consideration, because I think that we are seeing increasing evidence of very major bond investors expressing extreme caution with the market. That we have had a decade of extraordinary monetary policy. We have had a very lengthy period of time where interest rates have been close to zero. The Fed is the only central bank that is raising interest rates, and then the pace of those interest rates, well, so far we've had one, and if they raise in December, that would be one in a year. Perhaps it might be another year before they raise it again. So that is very, very moderate normalization of interest rates. In fact, it would be a stretch to call quarter point increases on an annual basis a normalization of interest rates. So there is the potential that the bond bull market could persist a while longer, that the excesses that have seen debt to GDP ratios expand at such an alarming rate, well, there isn't any real evidence yet that that has indeed ended. That, yes, the problem is enormous. It is going to cause a problem in future, but at the same time, it is also a factor that has not yet burst. So when we look at, for example, U.S. treasuries, that the yield has been trending lower for the last 2 years, and we hit a new all-time low in July. So that is something that is, a very meaningful event, that it has been trending lower in a choppy manner, that we had significant accelerations lower in 2008, in 2011, and now we were at a new low just in the last couple of months. And prices touched the region of the moving average just 2 weeks ago, and the yield posted a rather large outside day in here today. So it could have been an upside key to reversal had it held the move through the end of the session, but it didn't. But if we get follow through next week and we start to see this yield trading above 170 and holding that advance and then pushing on to new highs, well, then we could conclude that we've seen a higher reaction low, that it was a failed downside break below 140, that the yield is now trading back above the low that we saw last February, and that if it pushes back above the 200-day moving average, well, it'll be trading higher than the EMA for the first time since almost since 2015. And even then, yields will still be very, very low. And there is, and that isn't going to really challenge the total return index. And I continue to look at this. I look at it on at least a weekly basis, because it is perhaps the most consistent trend in the world. The total return on 10-year bonds has been going up since 1983. It's never really fallen. It had a somewhat larger pullback a couple of years ago, but it did not break the overall uptrend, and since then it has persisted up. And the only way that a strategy where people are just buying bonds and rolling them over, rolling over the futures, on the only way that that would stop working is if prices rise faster than, excuse me, if prices fall faster than the yield. And that is eminently possible. And that is why it is so important to recognize that if the bond yield right now is about 1.6, then even to get to 3.2 is still very low, and it would be a doubling of the yield that the 10-year future is trading in the region of about 130. And those are for contracts that redeem at par. So, if you're willing to pay that, then interest rates have to be very low to justify that decision. And then when you have negative interest rates, it is a very, very important point that you can't make money from them. So there is a certain desperation, and something that we see in absolutely every major bull market, and it is in every mania, in every crowd, is that the crowd is tolerant of contradiction. So in the 1990s, it was earnings don't matter, and of course earnings do matter. And for a time in the Imperial Palace in Japan, really was worth more than the entire state of California, and until of course it wasn't. And before the credit crisis, everybody thought that they could hedge their default risk, but not everybody can hedge their default risk. Somebody has to bear the risk. And now we're in a position in Europe and Japan where central banks are trying to sell the idea that you really can make money with negative interest rates. Well, no, you can't. That's ridiculous. It's absolutely laughable. And yet, people are falling over themselves because the banks themselves are buying the bonds as well. So it is an environment where people are just chasing the momentum. And generally speaking, when we've identified the contradiction, well, then we know what the eventual problem is going to be. So now there is a question. If we have spent so much time identifying what the problems are, how likely is it that the problems are going to manifest themselves into a major decline? Because I think that's a much more important question. Because when we look at that total return index on the bonds, it is still consistent. It is still trending upwards. It means that there is a problem. It will get worse before it gets, or at least it will create an even bigger bull market before it eventually pops. That's at least what the chart is telling us. The rise in yields that is looking increasingly likely is still likely to be moderate until, and we will monitor that chart very, very closely. Now, because central banks are so cautious about raising rates, and even then, it is really only the Fed doing that, there is no prospect of the ECB raising rates. And in fact, because of the problems in the banking sector, they may have to make monetary policy even looser. Well, if they're going to make it even looser, Japan is at a very interesting juncture. It is, I think it's very interesting that the second section index has broken out to new highs. And I think that that is something that's worth paying attention to, because it's a new recovery high, and this small cap index, the second section on the topics, has been such a reliable lead indicator. The Nikkei has been has not yet broken out. In fact, if you were to take the labels off the charts, the Nikkei looks exactly like the CAC in France, or at least and about half a dozen more European indices. And it really does need to get above 17,000. If it can sustain a move above 17,000, well, then it'll look a lot more like Apple, or it'll look a lot more like Germany. It will have broken the medium-term progression of lower rally highs, and it will give us at least some indication that demand has returned to dominance beyond just short-term steadying. Of course, what are we going to say about the yen? Because the yen has been appreciating all year, and it's been appreciating because of negative interest rates. The Japanese introduced negative interest rates in January, and the yen just went straight up. And of course, the reason why, because they are basically, when you are charging for deposits, you are withdrawing supply from the market. If you withdraw supply, then you support prices. That's why when you have quantitative easing and you're increasing the supply, well, asset prices go up because you're deflating the currency. You're inflating the currency, excuse me. So by deflating the supply, then they're inflating the price of the currency right now. But it has paused in the region of this 100 level. And what we saw just a couple of weeks ago was the Japanese saying that they were going to try something a little different. They were going to continue to target the yield curve. They were going to try and keep yields close to zero on the 10-year. Well, that's fine. But what it actually means is that they have not given up on their negative interest rate policy. And what they are in fact doing is not adding additional stimulus either. So it was in practice more of a we're going to hold things steady, or at least try to hold things steady announcement. But they may not have that luxury because of the downward pressure that the negative interest rate policy is having on the banking sector. And we are seeing that both in Japan and in Europe. And, you know, the ECB or the Bank of Japan can make liquidity available to the banking sector, but there is very little prospect of the banking sector being able to recover when they have had such an enormous burden of regulation imposed, and that they are then having their capital base eroded by negative interest rates. So when we think about it in those terms, it is also worth thinking about why are banks so important for economies overall? It's very simple. They are liquidity providers. And that's why we have so often looked at the banking sector as a potential lead indicator. But banks are not doing well in Europe or Japan right now. And they're and despite the fact that you've had Wells Fargo paraded in front of Congress for what has been a rather embarrassing set of events, the banking sector overall has been a lot steadier. Well, if negative interest rates don't work, it is really only a matter of time before they try something else. And then if they finally admit that what they are fomenting is deflation by having negative rates, then they may well turn to helicopter money. Now, if that is indeed the case, that would be directly inflationary. Their currencies would break downwards, and their stock markets in nominal terms, and I think it is very important to stress that it would be in nominal terms that stock markets would take off. Now, that also it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that it is currency market volatility has been responsible for the big move that we had in Europe last year. And then the fact that the euro has been reasonably steady this year has been more of a headwind, because without the bonus of a depreciating currency, then it has been more difficult for some of these stock markets to rally. Then when we look at the broader picture, where are we in the cycle? Well, we know that we're not early, that we've had negative interest rates for a year, we've had extraordinarily loose monetary policy for a decade, and now what we are starting to see is that the typical kind of instruments that would be expected to outperform in the latter stages of a bull market are turning to outperformance. So, for example, if we look at the London Metals Exchange, which has got a by and large a overall it's a recovery trajectory, and it's now trading back above the 200-day moving average, or if we look at the steel ETF, which is SLX, and that has held a progression of higher reaction lows all year and bounced from the region of the moving average. Look at, for example, BHP Billiton, and that being both an energy producer and one of the largest iron ore producers, and then it has been choppy, but it has held a progression of higher reaction lows just about all year. Glencore, which is one of the not only a miner but also a big trader of resources, has got a pretty similar pattern, that it has held this progression of higher reaction lows all year and broke out to new recovery highs last week and improved slightly on that performance this week. And if we're getting resources companies and mining companies, and then of course we've had the oil price, which has rebounded just about all year, and has been, I suppose, range bound for much of the last 4 months. But that is all feeding through to suggest that because valuations are reasonably high, because we are in an environment where there has been earnings deteriorating, that the reliance on liquidity has improved, that if but by and large economies have recovered, that we are not in the same dire economic straits that we were in 2008, that things are better, and because things are better, that demand for basic resources has recovered somewhat, and it has been a very difficult environment overall. So for example, like the and I'm tempted to use to think about the S&P 500 oil producers index as an example, because the FTSE 350 one has got a very big spike in it as a result of the decline of sterling. But if we look at the S&P 500 oil producers index, then that has also held a progression of higher reaction lows all year and moved to a new recovery high today. Now, that would suggest that what we are seeing is at least tentative evidence that resources are beginning to recover. But then we should really take a step back and look a little bit wider. So maybe look at Russia, and Russia has been recovering for most of this year, and the then more perhaps more diversified countries like Canada and Australia, have also returned to sort of positions of reasonable performance, if not outperformance. So then and there is, for example, in Australia, that it has held this rather choppy progression of higher reaction lows for most of the year, and what there's also evidence of is that the relative importance of the banking sector is being reduced somewhat by the recovery in the resources sector. So if you're getting the resources sector starting to pick up, then that really is an indication that it's a generally more positive tone overall for resources exporting countries, and a good number of the ASEAN countries, which also have some of the fastest expanding middle classes, are also benefiting as a result of that. But when you start stringing all of those sorts of charts together and you get this very clear commonality, then you must, I guess, begin to draw the conclusion that what we're starting to see is that the the kinds of assets that tend to perform best in the latter stages of a bull market are performing better. And because they are so depressed, then their percentage moves are relatively outsized. But the and because ASEAN, for example, not only has commodity exports, but it also has an expanding middle class that we're continuing to see that it is the consumer-oriented companies remain in positions of relative strength by and large. There have been some significant ones that have begun to roll over, and Disney and Nike and Starbucks are some of the shares that are not trending higher. But when you start to look at something like Pepsi, and then you're presented with a somewhat different picture. So, the reality is that there is a significant number of the consumer-oriented companies are still in medium-term uptrends, and a part of the reason for that is because they have, generally speaking, have got very respectable balance sheets and long records of increasing dividends, and because government bond yields have been so low that investors have been looking for a bond alternative. And that did feed through into some underperformance for some of them over the last couple of months, but there is a significant number still trading above their respective trend means. I don't think we can talk about the evolution of the consumer unless we start to talk about the Chinese market. But the A shares are so heavily influenced by the very large weighting of the finance and materials sectors, which are essentially government owned, that I prefer to look at the Shenzhen B shares as a better indication of what an index of newer companies with a significant private ownership bias to the index is doing. And by and large, it has been range bound, but it is at least not going down. And then when you start to look at some of the companies that are really starting to I guess represent China's new growth model, then Tencent or Alibaba are really starting to turn to outperformance here. So that would suggest that it is not all bad news in China, that certainly there are problems in terms of overcapacity, but the efforts underway to really encourage the consumer economy are bearing fruit. And I thought it was also interesting that just over the last couple of weeks, what we are beginning to see is sort of luxury goods type companies starting to break medium-term downtrends. And and that is a sector that is very heavily leveraged to the growth of the Chinese market. So when we start to see that, then I think there is potential that China is doing somewhat better. And of course, it isn't just China. India just this week tested its all-time high, and then they bombed Pakistan. Obviously the market then pulled back, and we might be in for at least an unwinding of the short-term overbought condition and some consolidation. It was looking likely anyway, but an uptick in geopolitical tensions has probably at least increased the potential that there is going to be at least some consolidation of what had been a very powerful move overall. When we then look at what are the things that are helping to drive this growth? Well, then the evolution of the global middle class is certainly one of them. Then, what we also have is the evolution of technology, and I don't think that there is anyone can really question that the Nasdaq 100 has been outperforming for a significant time. And that is something that is not a new story. But what we have seen, and I think it is important to look at that very long-term trend, that the index got all the way back up to test its 2000 peak. And then it spent a year and a half ranging, and there were some really quite violent drawdowns during that range. And and I think it is very easy right now to make a very bearish case. And we can really point to the bond markets, and we can point to the uptick in geopolitical tensions, and we can point to the just the deterioration of standards of governance and the rise of populism in places like Europe and in the US, and we could come up with a rather bearish forecast. However, monetary policy moves markets. It's usually the most important factor most of the time, and monetary policy is still very loose, and it is hard to argue with the fact that the Nasdaq 100 broke out to new highs, has had a somewhat shallow reaction, and has moved on to extend its advance. And there is also a temptation to look at companies like Amazon, to look at companies like Google or Microsoft, and say that they have done so spectacularly well that it is only a matter of time before they pull back. And you would certainly be correct in thinking that if something gets 20, 30% overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, then it is due a pullback. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that pullback is going to be imminent, or that it is going to take the rest of the market with it. What I think also is worth considering that what we did have over the last few months was a narrowing of breadth. That the story really was about the outperformance overall of a very small number of very large shares. Now, I think these charts are only updated to yesterday. We haven't got the new data in here yet, so they will have bounced additionally today. But the spider utilities, materials, healthcare, energy, industrials, I think also the financials, consumer discretionary, consumer staples, and technology have all bounced from the region of their 200-day moving averages, and technology has been leading on the upside. Now, if you're going to have a if you're going to promulgate a bearish case for the wider market, then at least some of those ETFs would have to be trading below their respective 200-day moving averages, and they just aren't. And that would suggest that yes, we have been through a very difficult period. We have been through a very tumultuous period in terms of the news flow, and that volatility that we've had within the range has really infected sentiment. And I use the word infected deliberately because it is the first big pullback would have had people worried, and the second big pullback will have increased the impact of that one event. Well, now we're seeing these markets trading at new highs, and they are being led higher by very large cap shares, which have their own ecosystems of suppliers that will also be benefiting from their outperformance. So if that is the case, then you just simply have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And if we are in the latter stages of a bull market, then the resources sector has really only just started going up, and it is nowhere near close to the highs that it was at 4 or 5 years ago. So it has ample potential to go up. The yield curve, which has compressed pretty steadily over the last few years, that is I think at about 70 basis points. And it isn't at zero. So because it's not at zero, then and zero is a very large psychological Rubicon, because if it were to go below zero, then that would offer us a two, well, I guess it's an 18-month lead indicator for a US recession. Now, of course, if you have a US recession, then that isn't something that you really get confirmation of right away, because obviously the economy has to contract for two consecutive quarters. So we would have an indication well early that that we're moving into a recession. Now, if it remains on its current trajectory, then that ratio might become inverted sometime in late 2017 or maybe even 2018, which would suggest that you get a recession at some point around 2019. And we are still only in 2016, so that would give us a window of opportunity for a significant bull market rally in the next 2 years. Now, it's being led higher by technology, and we have certainly seen that because there was currency intervention to stem the decline in currencies in right across Asia, that they are now starting to attract attention. And the big issue, the big question remains in the bond markets. And I think that is why it is so important to keep an eye on the influences of cross asset class interrelationships, because what we have seen over the what we've seen really over the last 6 years is just a complete change to the kind of environment that we had for pretty much all of time before that. Because if we look at the overlay between US Treasury yields and the S&P 500, then there is a very strong correlation that when the equity prices went up, bond yields went up. When bond yields went down, equity prices went down. But that changed in 2011 because we had massive monetary intervention. And what we had then was bond yields going down and equity prices going up, which meant, and it's also, of course, property prices have gone up. So extraordinary monetary policy has inflated a number of different asset classes simultaneously. And if one starts to decline, then it is likely to have a knock-on effect for the other ones that were inflated by the same motivating factor. So I really do think that the most important thing that we have to look at are those bond yields, and to keep a very close eye on them while also playing and relying on the consistency of the price action that we see in the Nasdaq and we see on the S&P 500. And isn't it a simple reason? Why is it that the US is doing so much better? Why is it outperforming Europe and outperforming Japan? And a number of other markets by such a wide margin? And is a simple reason because of the strength of the dollar. That because during a decade-long bear market for the dollar, a lot of dollars left the US and invested all over the world so that they could pick up the currency appreciation, the yield, and the capital market appreciation. But with the relative strength of the dollar, a lot of that money flowed back in and helped to sustain the bull market on Wall Street. Therefore, what needs to happen, I think, I suspect, is that massive currency weakness, a big decline for the dollar, would probably be a headwind for Wall Street overall. And I don't think anybody could say that there is a very clear trend right now on the dollar index. It has been going sideways for nearly 2 years, and it could really go either way. If we look at the long back history, then it would be I think the easy conclusion would be that it could go higher from here. But there is the outside possibility that it goes down first. And if that were the case, then that could be a potential headwind for the rally on Wall Street. So I think we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the rally on Wall Street, and there is the potential that Japan and Europe play catch up, that the resources sector is going to continue, that the relative strength of emerging markets should also continue, and the two things that could act as potential headwinds are a further, well, I guess it's three things: the further intensification of the problems that continue to exist in Europe, the potential for the dollar index to break on the downside, and potentially for bond yields to surge higher. And you'll notice that in all of that, I didn't mention valuations at all, because I think valuations are a factor of interest rates. That has certainly proved the case over the last number of years, and I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it isn't going to remain the case for the next few years. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I'm going to wish all the best to all of you.